Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Greetings from Miami. I'm here with the Lincoln Network, that's network, not project, team for Miami Tech Week. Before we get into today's show, I wanted to kick off with a shout out to everyone who's signed up for our paid Supercast subscription to support the show so far. It's been a little less than 2 weeks, and we're already one-fifth of the way to our original goal of funding for April 22 to April 2023. Here's how the subscription math works. The expectation is that 3 to 10% of our audience will pay some form of subscription. So if we get, let's say, 5% of our overall audience to subscribe to the subscription, we'll be wildly successful. So if you can afford to subscribe at the $5 a month, $50 a year, or even the $500 lifetime rate, the links at the top of the episode show notes on your podcast player as you're looking at this episode right now. And if you have any thoughts or requests for us as we end the soft launch of the subscription at the end of the month and go all in, email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com or reply or comment on today's Substack. Now, for today's episode, I'm speaking with return guest Mike Solana. Mike's the author of the excellent Pirate Wires Substack. I'm actually a very happy customer, and he's also a VP at Founders Fund, where he puts on events like last January's Hereticon. I didn't quite stick the landing on this question, so when I asked him at the start of the episode, what's his least heretical thought, I was basically hinting at the fact that he puts on an event like Hereticon, which is dedicated to thoughts and speech that are seen as heretical on the internet, especially given all the debates we're having around content moderation and speech on platforms like Facebook and Twitter. So the reason why I really want to speak with Mike this week, aside from just the fact that it's Tech Week, is Mike actually has joined the board of Lincoln Network, and we are very excited to have him. The way that we've been able to support the realignment for the past 2 years before we turn on the subscription has been through Lincoln Network's support through our grant via the Hewlett Foundation. So I wanted to take this episode as a chance to really shout out the work that Lincoln Network's doing and the type of people like Mike who actually are deeply involved and working with the type of stuff that Lincoln's focused on. So a lot of great things are going to come out on the Lincoln front this year. So this episode is really dedicated to that. With all that, I know these go a little long. I want to say a huge thank you once again to the Supercast subscribers and our supporters at Lincoln Network. Let's get into the episode. Mike Solana, welcome to The Realignment.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's great to speak with you, especially during Tech Week, because this is coming out on Thursday. So I want to start with a very obvious question that will have an unobvious answer probably. What is your most conventional, non-heretical thought that you have?
I have so many. Let's see. I love Justin Bieber. What is another good one? I mean, really, like, yeah, I think like a well-balanced diet and exercise are important. Family is important. Like maybe family is the most important thing. America is great. I love dogs. Like really, I am actually a fairly conventional person.
So I think that gets to the question, how do you place yourself? Because the reason why I started with that question is there's going to be a small degree of audience pushback saying, oh, you're just having another one of your VC bro friends on. And I think what's interesting about your space and the work that you're doing at Pirate Wires is that you're obviously writing from within tech, but you're coming at it from like a very specific angle. So let's just discuss, what would you say your editorial perspective is when it's looking at the intersection of politics, tech, culture?
I mean, the genesis of Pirate Wires, or maybe not the genesis of Pirate Wires, but the genesis of the, like, my perspective on tech, it comes from a place of tech press being relentlessly, I wouldn't say critical, I would say antagonistic to the industry. And I always thought, like, Yeah. Like actually the technology industry is really, it's enormous. It's wielding tremendous amounts of power. It deserves critique, but you're not critiquing any of the important things. Like you clearly just hate it. And that makes your critical voice useless because it's colored by that. It's completely toxic. You just want it to end and you don't want what tech wants. So like for me, the goal of the tech industry, obviously I'm working with tech people, surrounded by tech people, everyone wants to improve the world. All of it. And then it sounds cheesy now. I heard someone say the other day and I'm like, fuck, don't say that. It sounds cheesy, but it's true. They genuinely believe, we can build things we can build technology that makes tasks more efficient and produces more abundance for the average person. Genuinely, that's it. They are businesses. So yeah, a lot of them want to succeed. All of them want to succeed, but the goal is to make things better. And so that's a kind of progressive, that is a progressive vision, in my opinion, making the world more abundant, providing more things for more people and having us all work less. That is a progressive vision. So when I look at the industry and I get frustrated is when I feel like we are, that vision is being jeopardized by something else that's happening. And so, yeah, I would say I'm very critical of the industry. Actually, I'm not just this Pollyanna-ish, like, everything's great. We're amazing. It's not just propaganda. It's my opinion on things. And I feel like I am critiquing the industry in a way that I wish someone else would be critiquing it. And they hadn't been. And so I do it myself.
Okay. That's great. I've got two questions that come out of that, but let's start with the first one. What critiques are you just completely bored of / should the audience who doesn't work in tech be skeptical of, or just be willing to move on from?
Well, so I'm reading this book, The House of Morgan right now. And this is about the JP Morgan sort of, the 180 years or 50 years or whatever it is of their like dominance over finance. It's written by Chernoff, who wrote the Hamilton bio that everyone knows. It's his first one. And what I'm realizing is this thing where like people just hate rich people for being rich has always existed and it will always exist. I mean, separate from even what people, and lots of rich people have done lots of terrible things, but separate from that, just a public rich person, someone who's publicly very, very successful is always going to be hated. And a lot of what I see targeting Elon Musk, for example, it's Mark Zuckerberg, certainly, because Mark doesn't even do the crazy, annoying poke the bear things that Elon Musk does. Mark just, he like exists on a platform that's very influential and people hate him for it. And I think that like, that's not a criticism. Him being really influential and potentially dangerous is because like if some fantasy land like problem that you have, that's not a critique. Like what is the thing that he's doing that's wrong? What is the thing that the app is doing that is dangerous? And I think that you have to be tethered very closely to the facts at that point. And one place where it's like especially clear that that's not working, I think, is the like social media makes us want to kill ourselves debate. That is a story with the last I dipped into it, a couple of studies that were very small and there was nothing like in terms of just how social media affects the way that we think even. We don't know that. I think it's very valid it's a very valid assumption. Like it seems maybe pretty bad. We should look into it more. I agree with that. I think there should be studies. We should know how this stuff affects us. But most of the reporting on the topic is completely based on nothing. And most of the critique is based on nothing. Like all you have is your assumption. Great. Now let's look at what's actually the story here. So that's one. I would say everything with the election interference is like really not, I've not seen any really compelling evidence that like Facebook installed Trump as our president. And yet that's still sort of bandied about as if that's a thing. I think that, just the sort of knee-jerk assumption that people who are succeeding in tech are doing so in some sort of nefarious manner, that really bothers me because it's just not grounded in reality.
You know, something I'm curious about then is we're kind of in the middle of a prestige TV tech drama renaissance. I know you're gonna have thoughts on this. So you've got the Elizabeth Holmes Hulu show, you have the Uber one on Showtime, and you have the WeWork Apple TV one. What is your, you've said you're not happy with the shows, but what's your critique of the shows?
Well, the show, my critique of the shows is my critique of journalism is that I wouldn't say journalism of maybe like of media that surrounds tech. And that is the impulse that people have to focus on the absolute. Well, the Uber story is sort of separate because I feel like that I think in the case of Holmes and the WeWork situation, you're looking at like the absolute worst that tech is. And you're saying that this is who they all are. This is what the whole thing is. It's like, oh yeah, like the iPhone doesn't exist. Like personal computing doesn't exist. Semiconductors don't exist. Like none of these things exist. You'd have to search just a search engine, the power of a search engine. It's like, let's just pretend that never happened. Where's the Google movie? Where's the Steve Jobs, like, you know, 17 season deep, like deep dive into the heroics of what he did by leaving and coming back. There've been a couple of movies, but that
I was going to say, don't erase Michael Fassbender.
Well, that was terrible. Right. But I'm saying, but those movies also came, we are now in a uniquely negative tech press moment. And those Apple movies, I don't think could be made today. And even those Apple movies were not like, they weren't positive. I mean, they were negative portraits of the man, Steve Jobs, I would say. And then it's like, it's undeniable that he succeeded professionally. But these other ones, these other ones are not that. And in the case of Uber, I would say the portrait of him, I watched one episode. I'm like, this is not, it's a clownish portrait of a man who doesn't exist. It is a made up version of this. It's like the tech bro fantasy that exists only in the minds of journalists. There are no, I don't believe in the concept of a tech bro. I've never met a tech bro. I don't know what people mean when they say tech bro. I think what I'm hearing is like guy I don't like who is white and works in tech. That's what I'm hearing. And it's like, well, they're mostly what I encounter in tech are very nerdy people. And now in VC, increasingly, unfortunately, I will admit this, a lot of like finance type people, which I can't stand. But the average person.
Could you explain the difference? Because I know you came from like New York. So like the word like finance type person has a special meaning when you use it. Like what's the distinction between the nerds and the finance VC types?
Well, so mostly what you have populating the world of, I mean, most engineer, anyone who's a software engineer, it's very rare. Do you meet a bro-y software engineer? They're like, they're nerds. They're people who are focused on computers. They tend to be like a little more quiet. These are sweeping generalizations, but what I see generally, the average engineer I see, whether it's a guy, a girl, whatever race you want to pick, like they're all kind of the same. They're from the same mold. They're intensely analytical. They are intensely thoughtful and they're like stringing numbers and things together. Then you have your like more business sort of op side person tend to be very driven and ambitious, just work really, really hard and goal oriented, I would say. But that's no different than business. You know, they mapped kind of closely to the business archetype that you've seen forever. The finance type person tends to be maybe the finance person tends to be a little broier. Like you have this. It's an extroverted, like networky, who do you know kind of energy. And it's also like very like, yeah, man, we're crushing it. We're going to do like X, Y, and Z and we're going to be rich and baller, whatever. But even that is an arc. I mean, I'm stereotyping right now. And when you actually meet a person and talk to them, I mean, they're not, maybe they use a funny piece of language or something, but the actual bro, that the villain that exists inside of people's heads is, it's like not a real person.
I want to go back to something you said around people hating tech founders, because what I thought about was so much of that debate really comes down to, even when it doesn't get personal, it's about power. I'm a happy Pirate Wire subscriber, and I was reading like some of your on Elon and the speech and Twitter debates. And what I would just say is that even in, let's say, like centrist areas where we're not talking about socialists who like have all these beef with wealthy people. So a lot of these folks won't have problems with people who just have money. It's very specific. It's how the money and the power that money represents is really utilized. So how do you just think about that aspect, which is that the good faith pushback to you is that the hate, quote unquote, is deep dissatisfaction with how the power that tech as software eats the world, to use almost the cliche at this point, is really utilized.
Yeah. So I have a couple of thoughts. My first is that I don't think in the case of Elon Musk hatred specifically, so from the press, it's like they hate everyone who is wealthy and successful in tech. That's just, they're always going to be suspicious. They're always going to be targeted. That's just like what's going to happen. From the average person, what I've noticed is when people are frustrated with Musk, oh, like he bought whatever and he's a billionaire, he could like solve world hunger. That was a big one when people were like, why won't you solve world hunger, Elon Musk? What I was thinking of was actually how strange it was compared to other billionaires. There are so many billionaires out there who no one has ever heard of, and no one's asking them. No one's even asking Warren Buffett to solve world hunger. Why? Why is no one going after Warren Buffett? I think it's because Warren Buffett has never actually built something that has materially changed the world. And we know that. We clock that as he's not the useful kind of billionaire. Elon Musk is a billionaire who's building rocket ships that land. That is startling. And we're like, whoa, that's one of our few examples that we have of someone who's actually changing the material world. And so in a weird way, I think the average frustration that bubbles up around Elon Musk is something I've written about a bit in Pirate Wires, is it's like somewhat counterintuitive at first, but I think actually a lot of the like angry energy surrounding him comes from a place of, it's almost a compliment. It's like, you are someone who can do something. Why can't you do more? Why can't you do everything? Meanwhile, I mean, Elon Musk, his entire wealth, like, I mean, if he's a complete combined wealth, his stake in Tesla, SpaceX, everything else, this is a fraction of the US government's buying power. So like if it's so easy to snap your fingers and solve world hunger with a few billion, why isn't the government doing it, right? Why isn't the government doing any of these things? Why isn't the government fixing our education system or transportation or bridges and roads and tunnels are fucking crumbling in San Francisco or in California? I remember a bridge going down to Big Sur was down for a year. Like, that's crazy. If it's just a matter of money, why aren't we doing something with, you know, the trillions that the US government is spending? And that, I think, just in general, when I talk about the tech stuff, I think that is one of the things that I always have in the back of my mind that animates me here, is like the sense of this is disproportionate anger that you're placing on the wrong person. Like, there are actually people who are responsible, who we have elected, and their job is to make the material stuff of this country run, and it's not running, and we all feel that. I mean, the fact that you can't buy a house that is affordable, that comes down to policies that have been put in place by our elected leaders. And like, that is a huge psychic burden on the average person. And that is, I think, what drives a lot of this persistent negative feeling that exists right now. It's just like, things are not affordable and things are not working and we're paying a lot in taxes, but you can't send your kid to public school in a big city. Like, that's a crazy situation that has nothing to do with these people. It has to do with this giant problem that I think is not nearly critiqued enough, because the average media person is very leftist, and this entire government is, I mean, even when it's a right-wing government, the bloat of it is a leftist idea, to have a giant government in charge of everything, which I'm not even opposed to conceptually anymore. I've drifted far from libertarianism. I just want the thing to work, and I want us to criticize the people who are actually in power, and our government, that's actual power.
Okay, so that's interesting. And I'm glad you said you weren't a libertarian anymore, because I was going to start this question by saying you're a libertarian, Mike. So here's the first question. So when you were talking about how you feel as if the press is too suspicious towards basically, I want to say like this tech billionaire class, the obvious devil's advocate that's going to come out here is, well, the press wasn't too suspicious of Elizabeth Holmes when Forbes put her on the cover. So
there's a very clear reason. I mean, the reason they weren't suspicious of Elizabeth Holmes, not only were they not suspicious of Elizabeth Holmes, the press invented Elizabeth Holmes. There are almost no serious investors that we would know who are propping up Theranos. What was happening there, very obviously, was the media had, and this is not, I'm not making a broad critique of women in tech or talking about the difference between men and women. I'm just telling you what the press wanted at that moment. The press wanted a young, beautiful, female billionaire. to represent the new face of tech. They had a very strong narrative about like the future of is female and like we're going to do diversity and like here is this woman billionaire. Finally, women have a chance. And so she was on the cover of every magazine, right? Like she was out every story about billionaires, she was involved. Every story about like the new face of tech, she was involved. And that generated her buzz. It was a diversity narrative that the press was running with and they were obsessed with her. And that is what happened there. I would say, yeah, they should be more suspicious of their own biases. They should be more suspicious of the stories that they themselves want to tell. They should check those. I try and check those myself in my own writing because there are all sorts of stories that I know are too good to be true, that, that coincide too perfectly in what I believe. When you see a meme, a lot of us do this online, you see a meme or a viral video clip or something of someone who you don't like saying something very stupid. And it's like, if it's too stupid, you got to wait. You have to like look for more context. You have to see the broader video clip, whatever. This is about all of us. I think maybe the nice version of this is that I would like to believe that we're just new to the internet as a species. And this is just a learning curve. And we're going to get better at checking our own biases and whatnot. I don't know if that's the case, you know, because we've always had biases and we've never checked them. But I just think now in the world of information that you live inside of, it's a more dire situation. We kind of have to evolve.
Yeah. I want to get to the virality point in a second, because you've done a lot of good writing on that. I'm curious about what your takeaway then has been reading Chernow, right? So you're talking about, we're having this conversation about suspicion and power. And like, once again, like the financial industry played the role that tech plays in our society today. Dynamic, growing, gains going to certain individuals. Like, what lesson are you taking from reading about JP Morgan? I'm curious.
The lesson that I'm taking away is that money doesn't make you happy. That's like the main lesson I'm taking away. It's on a high level. It's on a high level about like the world, the shape of the world thing. It's more a deeply personal thing. I think it's interesting that there are people who are relentlessly ambitious. I mean, it's not everyone, it's not universal, but I've seen this again and again in these biographies of people who just are not able to take a victory. They're not able to feel happy when they've achieved something spectacular, and they almost move on because they feel like they have to. Certainly that was the case of Morgan number two. I'm blanking on his name. He has a fun sort of long, weird name that starts with a P. It's like a very unusual name. This is the son of the first guy who started the whole thing. But he was also like he was the genius of the institution. And that's what I'm learning from that. In terms of like shapes of power and things like that, there's always been power. There have always been powerful people. Powerful people have always exerted their power on other people. And the great thing about America is it was a system of checks on power. It was like this very, it was a group of people who were very cognizant of this dynamic of the powerful, the impulse in the powerful to control the less powerful. And that was the whole thing is set up to protect people from the powerful by guaranteeing rights. That's, yeah, I don't know if it's something that I'm learning from this. It's something that I've kind of picked up on.
Yeah. And this is also in the billionaire category. And this is, I think there's a lot of, like you said, that Elon could solve poverty with a pretty easy check writing campaign is just literally nonsensical. And that's one of those, like, you see that tweet and it's like, come on, turn your brain on for two. Like, that actually can't like, whether you like Elon Musk or not, that can't possibly be true on 15 different levels. But the thing, a critique that I'm interested in from the left of, it's not really even a critique of Elon Musk, it's a critique of American society. So it's saying, and Bernie expresses the thing sometimes when he says the US government, right? This collective thing used to do these big things, right? Used to say we're going to do the Apollo program.
I mean, this
used
is Peter's,
to build the Hoover Dam.
This is Peter Thiel's critique of
yeah. So what do you think it says about American society then? That it feels as if these institutions that are public cannot accomplish the things that now individuals are doing.
I mean, it's really a problem. I think it's a huge problem. I think that the critique is right. I don't know that it's a matter of like, we have just the wrong people in, or maybe this is just what happens after a country is sort of sufficiently mature. Like you build up all these bureaucratic processes that just get in the way of you being able to do anything meaningful. And that's like, that could just be where we're at in history. Is there, it's just too hard to do stuff. There, we're just kept from doing stuff by these almost invisible forces. It's like the, what is the word I'm looking for? It's a physics term. The
entropy. Anyway, like,
yeah, entropy. Yes.
It's wow, like that's incredible. High school, man.
So I think that maybe, maybe it's that. Yeah. I think it's correct. It's we're right to say that America's not doing anything grand anymore. I would say Bernie Sanders doesn't really believe that. Bernie Sanders never believed those things were great. Bernie Sanders never believed the Apollo stuff was great. He that's the leftist thing about America is that we're just evil. And I think any sign of us being great is seen suspiciously. Bernie Sanders has voted. He's never, there's never been a NASA budget that he's been excited about and that hasn't voted against. So he recently, he's been talking all about how, you know, we can't have these billionaires in space. You know, this has got to be an America job. And it's like, well, you had the chance to do it and you didn't want to fund it. You were against it. And so actually, like, it's all lies and we have to just pretend that they're not lying to our face. Bernie Sanders' problem is not that Elon Musk is going to space. Bernie Sanders' problem is with Americans going to space. He does not, the steel man of him is he doesn't think there's anything valuable up in space. I think my read of leftism, generally speaking, is this sense that people are bad and Americans in particular are bad. And so the propagation of us people, the human race, is inherently bad. It's going to be bad for nature. It's going to be bad for the world. It's going to be bad for the cosmos if we start going out there. And you might think I'm crazy, but peek into any debate about infecting other planets with life. There's a whole debate surrounding Mars and whether or not we should go at all because we could bring bacteria there that could hurt this pristine world. And it's like, who cares? Like, honestly, it's a barren wasteland. Like, why is that more important than spreading life into the cosmos? I don't understand. And that's something that I really believe is true. I can see it animated because it is behind every policy decision. This is the whole, when you want to talk about that, space is one context, energy is another context, where we have this answer in nuclear power. We can produce more energy for less. And there's anger there and resistance to it. And there's a desire to want to go and use, you know, solar power and wind. And then you look at it and you say, hey, but we don't have enough solar power and wind to power the planet. We'll never be able to do it in a way that won't cause mass starvation. And the reason this argument doesn't go anywhere is because I'm not saying leftists want people to die. What I'm saying is leftists want less people to exist. They want us to be using less power, period. And my desire is for us to be using more power and doing more things. I want everybody to have more, and I want to do it in as efficient and clean a way as we possibly can. Nuclear is a solution. The reason we're not talking about it is because of this leftist philosophical belief that people, there should be less of us.
Yeah. You know, my real beef with the Bernie argument is that even if, let's say, Elon Musk didn't exist, we wouldn't be back on the moon. These things, right? Like, literally, so like, not just, so let's put aside for a second the idea, like, let's say if you took an extra $10 billion from Elon Musk, that would not ergo result in a renewed American space program. I think something has been useful for.
You would never even see it. The San Francisco budget I've lived in San Francisco for 10 years. The budget of San Francisco has doubled from $6 billion to over $12 billion. It might be close to $13 billion at this point. Nothing has changed. Things have gotten worse. That's all that has changed. Things have gotten, it has doubled and things have gotten worse. I'm talking, when I say things, I mean transportation has gotten worse. The problem of human, like, shit on the ground has gotten worse. The homeless problem has gotten worse. The drug problem has gotten worse. The crime problem has gotten worse. Everything, and by crime, I'm not talking like in real numbers, every single crime added up. I'm talking about people breaking into your house while you're there. That problem has gotten worse. The drug problem, the violence on the street problem, all of these problems have gotten worse. Where did the money, where is it going? It goes into a black hole and we never see it again. And so, yeah, these budget conversations are always, they're always lies. I mean, it's like we forgot that Biden just passed the transportation, or what was it? The infrastructure bill. Where is that money going? It was an historically massive bill. We have spent, adjusted for inflation, we spent more on this infrastructure bill than Apollo, Manhattan, the interstate highway system and the Human Genome Project combined, okay? Combined, adjusted for inflation. Where, like, what are we going to have to show for this infrastructure bill? That's a huge problem that there's no one tracking that and saying, hey, like, you're spending over $1 trillion. Like, we really need to know where the fuck this is going. It's mind blowing to me.
Yeah. I want to get to the vision question then. Cause I like when you talk about the direct politics like this, but what is a national project? So like, let's just take it as a given. Like you said, you're not a pure libertarian anymore. You've got billions of dollars worth of budget. Like, what national project that could intersect with tech, that couldn't intersect with tech, whichever you want to pick, what would you undergo?
I think that you could do a nuclear powered America where you are bringing nuclear power plant. You're trying to meaningfully increase the generation of nuclear power in the country, maybe get us up to a quarter of our energy is off of nuclear, while concurrently putting tons of money into a Manhattan style research project surrounding something like fusion, like putting everything that we have into getting a jump in science while we're doing this engineering project. That was the cool thing about what we saw back in the, let's say 40s and 50s and even 60s, is you had all of this money in research as well as actually doing stuff. Like, there was money that was going into both, into learning new things and into doing more with what we are now learning. And I think that would be a cool one. I think that the other one that I'm really excited about is a sort of terraforming project on Earth. I think that I'm really tired of talking about the amount of carbon that we're putting in the atmosphere. I think that we obviously need to talk about how to remove carbon that's already in the atmosphere from the atmosphere. And there are all sorts of ways to go about this. There are theoretical ways, right? We're talking about things like ocean seeding, which is seeding the ocean with iron to generate, I believe it's plankton, which would draw carbon from the atmosphere. The fish will eat it. Now you have food and you have less carbon in the atmosphere. You have things like giant solar shields over the planet. I think that one is a little bit scary. You have people talking about releasing chemicals into the atmosphere, also sort of scary. But I mean, it's something that we need to think about and we need to do something about just based on their own argument. The argument of the sort of global warming is an apocalypse that is already happening sort of argument, if you believe that. Ocasio, I think, probably 3 years ago now, said the planet was going to end in 12. That's a pretty big deal that we have an apocalypse coming in 9 years. If you believe that, you already believe there's too much carbon in the atmosphere. You already believe if we stop everything we're doing right now, global warming is happening and it will be catastrophic. That's the project. We should be removing carbon from the atmosphere. We should be trying to control the weather of the planet.
When it comes through in your work and your writing, and I also suggest that folks who want to get a good articulation of this vision, that you go to Founders Fund's Twitter page, and there's a video from your board meeting in September 2020 that just is very just like retro futurist science-y. And I want you to talk about science for a second, because that's coming through in what you're saying. How do we go all in on science, nuclear, carbon sequestration, all that stuff, without it getting infected by politics, culture wars, like those different bits?
Well, the cool thing about the Manhattan Project was no one knew about it. So first of all, I love that. Love a secret government project to, let's do one, but for energy, that would be cool. I don't really believe that everything the government does has to be, I'm not like I think some things are impossible to do under a microscope. And
like what?
Maybe that would be like war. First of all, if you're in war, I think there's no way to win one really under the microscope. It's like the asymmetry there when you're battling. We tend to be in conflict I think always in the history of America, we've been in conflict with, maybe not in the history, but for the most part, I think like this Spain might've been a slightly different situation, but certainly the UK was a slightly different situation, you know, day one. We tend to be in conflict with people who are not free themselves in a meaningful sense. And those countries, autocratic countries, they do whatever they have to do to win. And that a big part of that is hiding your cards. And so in war, yeah, I think that it's really hard to be transparent, but then like, obviously the lack of transparency during the Manhattan Project, which was a war project, you know, that was helpful. Probably with Apollo, it was the same thing. You want to hide your secrets and things like this. But also maybe that was technically in a way a war project as well. But something that I struggle with, honestly, is I wonder how much of our accomplishments that I really love the most were just war projects. I think that the interstate highway system is not a war project and also really important and good, but
even that, right? Like the argument is that enabled you to move tanks around the country quickly. So that's a cold war project in a way too. You know, something I'm wondering about then, and because I want to get into like the social media stuff, which everyone is definitely here for. How has the war in Ukraine really intersected with everything you're talking about here? Because in I can't remember which piece this was, but you basically were describing modern social media as basically a failed experiment. And there's all these like domestic political things that are falling into that, but there is this international aspect, aka with Russia, China, et cetera, making very clear that different countries are going to have different geopolitical tech stacks, different apps are going to go to different places. So just talk about that expansively, however you want to go with it.
Well, I think it was in the piece called War that I touched on it. and the first thing I noticed was that, well, I mean, obviously social media is tech generally, and social media in particular, is a new front of war in a way that we've never seen before, where these suddenly are really important strategic assets for countries in the middle of severe existential conflict. So there's no country that's looking at this right now and thinking, oh yeah, I definitely want our, you know, entire media apparatus to be owned and operated by five very sort of like the American flavor of left-wing rich people in Silicon Valley. Like, there are zero world leaders, including zero European world leaders, who want that. So like the future is just not that. Nobody wants that. No one's interest other than that's it. Maybe in the global hegemony would have been in the interest of Silicon Valley executives only. So other than them, nobody else wants that. So it's not going to exist. I think Russia and China will have their own stacks. I think Europe will have it. Probably the other, it will be a little bit of a drag. It will take more time before you see this in different parts of Africa and whatnot. I think that in the case of, yeah, I mean, no, that's just, I think that the tech thing, the social media thing parallels globalism generally in a way that, like, while it was happening, you sort of thought, oh, this is inevitable. Obviously everybody will be using, everyone on the whole, in the whole world will be using the same exact Twitter, everyone. It's crazy to think of that now as a realistic thing, but 10 years ago, it seemed totally normal. It seemed, you could never compete against it. So why wouldn't it happen? Everyone wants to be where everyone is. We didn't think about things like national interest and we didn't even think about social media as a scary thing. And so one thing that I've written a lot about the last couple of years is the unknown unknown. So what is the kind of information that could spread really fast that could potentially cripple the planet in a day? Like I don't think we've seen that yet, but I do believe that we're now open to something where, like, the existence of globally scaled information, rapid globally scaled information that's only existed for the last 10 years, really. So like, what is the worst negative externality there? And I don't think we know what that is. And that does concern me. And it's not something that I even was on my radar 10 years ago. I thought it's social media. It's just people talking, like, who cares? So I think that's something that more and more people are thinking about and are going to, I don't want to say protect against, but they're going to design against. Like, you're going to see more closed systems, and then we'll see what happens with American social media. So I think globally that's certain, but the American social media question is a little more open. And I think there, at the heart of that question, is a question of whether or not America will remain free or become a more authoritarian country.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just thinking, as you were describing 10 years ago, I said, well, you know, like, The Social Network came out 10 years ago, but The Social Network wasn't actually about, like, Facebook, the platform is it just exists. Like, The Social Network, which I think is an amazing movie, could have been about any company. it was about the relationships, the founders, like it, that Facebook itself wasn't actually.
I don't think people on Facebook were in the social network were even talking about like the dark side of social media. And what the average person means is like, it makes us happy. And like teens want to kill themselves. And like all there's the evidence there is very up in the air. We don't know, but no one's talking about things like, what does it mean when someone, a single person is a cult leader to 100 million people? It's weird to see. And we had versions
is that like
of
a
this
Trump reference.
Well, I don't think we've seen the, no, it's not. I think that that's something that now that we know is possible that has not yet existed. I think that the craziest incarnation of this hasn't happened yet. And, but I think at this point it's like an obvious insight. It's an obvious prediction. Like you're going to see people who are just uniquely influential, people who are more influential and immediately influential than ever before in history, where you can suddenly, from the push of a button, a single person can have 20,000 people flood a single city and cause whatever. I mean, that's possible. It's conceivable.
You keep making references to like virality as the thing that's really concerning for you. You've written about this. So can you just explain, because my interpretation of your writing is you're less concerned about specific content. You're more concerned about the way any type of content can just go 0 to 100. So can you explain this viewpoint?
Yeah. I think that everyone focuses on misinformation right now. That's the conversation about social media. It's like people are saying things that are wrong. And it's like, first of all, define wrong. I mean, we could get lost for hours in this question of misinformation on topics like COVID and the war and whatever else, where people can get locked into a debate and never agree. And I look at that and I think, okay, I have my own opinions on what is true and what's not. But the important thing to me about this conversation, the important thing to keep in mind is that people have been fighting over what's true forever. For as long as there have been people, we've been fighting over this. And for as long as there have been people, for as long as there's been information, there's been misinformation and disinformation and information war. Like those things have always existed. The only thing that's different is the pace at which a single piece of information spreads. And that is different in a huge way, right? Like we're talking, and it's so huge that I think we have a hard time processing it or something, but like I can tweet something and 100,000 people can see it in a couple hours and I'm nobody, right? Like I have 100,000 followers on Twitter. If I 15X that or 100X that, right? Like you're talking about instant global, the instantaneous global scale of a single piece of information that could be true or could not be true, or could be could be weaponized in some way. And so that's the thing, like the pace of information, the speed of information and the movement of that, that had only ever been seen as a positive. And I think it is positive in so many ways. But the negative externalities innate of that, that's something that I think a lot about. And the reason I think a lot about it is because we just don't know what the worst dangers there are, and nobody seems to want to even look at it. And the reason I think nobody wants to look at it, there are two. One is just a fundamentally new question, which makes it weird and hard to wrap your head around. There are no analogs in history to sort of go back on and be like, well, it's like the printing press. It's not. It's a new thing. And so you have to think about it in a new way. And that's just exhausting. But then also the people who are beating the drum on misinformation, like their problem isn't misinformation. They spread it themselves. Their problem is the information being spread by people they don't like, by people they want to put in their place. They love the instantaneous, viral piece of information, right? They love it when they're spreading it themselves, and they've spread plenty of mistruths themselves about everything from COVID to, let's think of some other good ones. We've got COVID. We have the crime issues in our cities. I have a piece actually on Pirate Wires where I just like go through like every single thing over the last few years, the origin of the virus. Like there are all these things that we've been lied to about Hunter Biden's laptop, right? Like they don't have a problem spreading misinformation. And we'll never hear about their mistakes again once they've been proven wrong and we kind of move on. They have a problem with other people spreading information. But I have a problem, generally speaking, with a single piece of information hitting everybody at once. I would say maybe not a problem. It's a question. I think that there's that's the scary thing to me. The only scary thing, because it's the only thing that we don't really know.
Yeah, I want to focus in on this unknown, you know, knowns. I've got the Donald Rumsfeld RIP quote in my head there, obviously, because specifically when you're talking about the children thing, right? So, and right, that's a super euphemism, the children thing. If you're talking about claims that social media is like increasing suicide, self-harm, like those different bits, how do you suggest we think about these deeply existential problems when we just honestly have no idea? And like you said, if we were to just Google for 2 seconds, we could find studies going in both directions. How should we just, like, as consumers of information, people who are in these spaces, just think about that?
Well, I don't think it's a dumb thing to worry about. Like, I think that anything that's new, I don't believe that new things are inherently good and every new thing is the world becomes a little bit better. I think that there are trade-offs in every direction, and it's correct to be suspicious of new things, honestly. And it's healthy to raise questions about how they're affecting us. Probably I would always exercise caution, honestly. I think you want it to be optimistic, like you want to be moving in a positive direction, and you want to have a goal in mind for the sort of a progressive technologically progressive world of abundance. That's the goal. You want to be walking towards that, but you do need to be cautious at every step of the way. And it would be silly to think that you don't, given, you know, all of the mistakes we've made, just even in the narrow realm of medical science, for example. You know, every 50 years you look at the medicine, it's completely different. And you have endless horror stories of where we went wrong and mistakes that we made. We're always learning. And, I think social media, it's like, in terms of just the, if you get away from the really abstract questions and just talk about, like, is it making people happy or not? It's like, I don't know, if you're unhappy, maybe don't use it so much and see how you feel. Like, these are hard things to say. So much of what comes down to our life is, it's like in our own hands. And that's a philosophical question that people just don't agree with right now. I think that's actually one of the more heretical, it's like a heresy that exists in all these sub heresies. The underlying tension is like, do you believe that people control their own lives or not? And if you mm-hmm. believe that people control their own lives, you are a heretic and a half. You can't say that. And that manifests in things like hustle porn. People hate hustle culture because they think it's all fake. Meritocracy, they don't believe in the concept. The education debate right now surrounding advanced classes and like AP things and whatnot in San Francisco, the idea that math is racist. All of these things come down to the whole poverty debate, everything having to do with welfare. Like, I mean, it all is like, there's a lot that you can justify if you believe that the partitioning of resources has been truly random and everyone's life is totally static and out of their control.
You know, it's interesting. How much, I mean, I was asking you the question directly, how much control do people have? So for example, I'll give the most like good faith example. Let's talk about these issues of like Instagram, teen girls, very specifically. To your point, a obvious response is, okay, so then as a parent, make sure your child doesn't have a smartphone, isn't on Instagram, this or that. If a parent, let's say, like, works two jobs, is super busy, what's the degree of control that one has over these great forces?
Well, this I just refuse to acknowledge. This narrow question, I think, is not serious. The idea that a parent can't control whether or not their teen has a phone is insane to me. Like, you're the parent, you're in charge. This happened in one of the hearings. There was a tech hearing when one of the Facebook people was like, yeah, I mean, we expect the parent to, like, obviously be an authority on what the kid can and can't do. And they're like, you expect parents to control what teens are doing on their phone? And it's like, you literally control, you're paying the phone bill. Is that a joke? Like, you are in charge. You're literally in charge. You're the parent. That the idea that a parent isn't in charge, I can't understand that. But in terms of the control, like how much control do you have over your own life? I think it's very high. I think it's like 75-80%. And then there are obviously all of these things that you can't control, where you're from, how much money your parents had, who your parents knew. Those are probably the big ones. I think how attractive you are is the weird one that no one wants to ever talk about. But that's like definitely out of your control. But all of these things, it's like you control your own. Every day you wake up and you control the decisions that you make. And that is just a fact of life, you know? You get dealt a deck of hands, but you get dealt a deck of hands that's new really almost every day. There's some new bunch of random things popping around, and you are in control for the most part. There are always exceptions to the rule. You know, people always want to be like, but what about a paraplegic mother of six with no husband? Like, yeah, it sounds really hard for her, but not for you, not for the person making the argument right now, right? Like they're bringing up this abstract person to absolve themselves of responsibility for their own life. And the average person in general does have control over their own life.
You know, I agree and disagree with you, but I think your point that this actually is one of the most truly heretical thoughts. If you just think about the ways that this base argument plays into basically every single major debate in our society right now, like, for example, like misinformation, disinformation, to what ability does one have the ability just to say, hey, like I, as a consumer, are going to take responsibility. Like it actually, now that I'm thinking about it, this actually is at the root of basically every single culture war, domestic, get in a fist fight at a bar argument that we're actually looking at. So that's actually a really good one. Just to think about it that way.
Yeah, it always reduces. And not always. I mean, there are exceptions, but for the most part, it reduces to that. In the misinformation, when I saw there was an Axios report, I wrote about this last week or the week, I think it was last week, in Freedom is for Nazis. They addressed.
So yeah, you wrote that piece specifically.
Yes, there was a piece called "Freedom Is for Nazis" at Pirate Wires that I wrote, and I start like the Axios thing was the first really shocking example of this to me. There was a real shift in the way that people think about the concept of free speech, whereas I think in the past, it used to be a value that everyone shared for the most part, and then I would say over the last decade, we've hidden a lot behind the question of legality. You know, we'd say, oh, there's this crazy example of censorship on social media. And people would not say that's wrong or that's right. They would say, well, that's legal. You know, it's a company, and it's not a public asset. It's privately run company. They have free speech as well. They can do whatever they want. And we would always sort of dance around the actual fight, which was a question, not of the legality, not of legal free speech and the question of that. What we were talking about was free speech, the value. And no one wanted to address that head on because we all were raised believing that people who didn't believe in free speech were evil and that free speech was this like sacred value. And I believe that for the most part, I mean, very close to that. I'm extremely a free speech person. I think the anti-free speech people, and I believe they really are anti-free speech at this point, we have to actually start calling them that, they were lying to themselves as much as to the rest of us. They didn't want to face the fact they're actually authoritarian and they're actually requesting something authoritarian in nature. But now with the Elon Musk Twitter situation, I mean, the mask has been lifted, okay? These people are out here making very clear arguments against free speech as a value. They're saying it is wrong to allow people who have bad ideas to voice those ideas because other people can't control themselves and they're just going to hear that and absorb it and do whatever. And I think maybe there's some truth to that. Maybe there are a lot of people who really do just do whatever they're told and whatever they hear. It's actually something I struggle with, is the question of, well, libertarians always want to do this thing where they say freedom is the best thing for everyone. And they apply this to things like the immigration debate and the gun debate. And with the gun debate, let's say, libertarians are always trying to have their cake and eat it. They're trying to say like, no, like the more guns make for a a safer society. There are less gun deaths, or they don't really say there are less gun deaths, but they have all these crazy arguments to get around the fact that like there's a trade-off taking place, and the trade-off is freedom and dead people. And it's like, we make that trade-off in a million different directions. We make it with cars. You know, we don't have to be driving to work, but we do. And there's a trade-off there in life, in actual lives lost. Gun debate is that for me. It's like, you should be able to say, actually, the value is so important that yes, some people are going to die. That's what happens in a free country, is sometimes there are mistakes and it's worth it. And that's the honest debate that they don't want to have. So I'm kind of getting lost here, but the Axios thing, that to sort of tie it back, what they said explicitly was the question of what you're going to consume, who you're going to follow, and what news you're going to read is now, shocking, crazy aberration in history, going to be in the hands of consumers. Whereas previously, it had always been a question sort of mediated by the government and media, which to me seems like almost a false version of history. But they can they end the whole thing with the phrase, like, the world that we're approaching. And the world that they illustrate is a world of astonishing, this is a quote, astonishing individual freedom. And it's like, what do you do with that? What do you do with people who are just openly like, this thing, and by thing, I mean, literally the concept of freedom is itself the problem. That's a new fight. And we're not going to be able to just say, oh, it sounds like you don't believe in free speech anymore, and end the debate that way. We're going to have to actually start defending it. And that's just sounds exhausting and like a weirdly much more difficult problem than we're maybe wanting to believe. You got to keep in mind that most countries don't have free speech. We're the only one that has this robust of a free speech. It's a huge aberration.
The example for folks is like the First Amendment, once again, like the literal First Amendment is a, because people like dunk on American exceptionalism. Like, this is a very straightforward example of American exceptionalism, even within the West, like, right? Even compared to like the United Kingdom. So yeah. I want to close with this question then, which is that just as so many root debates come down to this, how much degree of individual like autonomy does an individual have? We said this earlier. The other episode we've released this week is by Yasha Munk just wrote a book about diverse democracies and whether they could function in the 21st century. And so much of what we're talking about here really comes down to this debate of how much can diverse people, diverse viewpoints, categories, how much can they function in a shared space together? This is what you were saying when you were pushing back on the utopianism around like, oh yeah, like everyone's just going to hang out on Twitter. Like, what is your answer to the question of whether you're optimistic that all these different, let's say, lack of shared view perspectives can successfully and productively navigate towards, once again, yeah, you said,
no, I don't believe in
progressive world of abundance.
I don't believe that a nation can survive. I think that it's like we focus so much on racial diversity, and that diversity matters zero. That does not matter at all. Like, yes, as much diversity or as little, like, it doesn't actually materially change anything. It has no influence. The problem is a lack of diversity or a lack of, like, you can't have a nonstop diversity of like core values. You can't have diversity of core values at all, actually. Like, you can have diversity of superficial opinions and even directions, like, generally speaking, on like maybe a diversity of strategies for how to get to something that we maybe all want, for example, cheap energy or something. Like, that's great. Let's have a diversity of ideas. But the actual value of no, we want abundance for everybody on the planet, or we want freedom. Like, you either believe that or you don't. And America was historically a place of, we fought over, God is a great example of this. It was a Christian nation with like a lot of different kinds of Christianity. It was like a lot of people who wanted like roughly the same spiritual thing. I think that at the level of the nation state, like, freedom is one of these things that you have to believe in it, generally speaking. And if you don't, there is a fundamental conflict that you will fight over until you figure it out. And that happens by either converting the other group or going your separate way. In the context of America, that's very hard because there's a diversity, not between regions, but between cities and the agrarian part of it, like cities and country. So I'm not sure.
Even red state, blue state doesn't capture it to your
point. I think that it might just be like a sort of rough environment for a while. It might be a rough sort of polarized culture for quite a while.
Well, we started with a world of abundance. We ended with a rough polarized culture. Mike, this has been really great. Can you just shout out Pirate Wires for folks who want
to? I would love to, guys. Check out piratewires.com. That's where I write every other week. And I'm Mike, M-I-C Solana, S-O-L-A-N-A at Twitter. Thanks for having me, man. I love this podcast. And I'm stoked to see you. You're in Miami, right?
I'm going to be tomorrow. So,
and I will see you. I'm here for Tech Week. So I will see you here for Miami Tech Week.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.